Yeah, I'd like to call the meeting to order, March 6th, for the Environment Natural Resources Committee. Today we are going to be, first of all, maybe we should approve the minutes. We're going to approve the minutes for March 4th. Anyone gotten a chance to review the minutes and like to move them? Representative Dale or Representative McNamara?
I'll move the minutes.
Representative McNamara moves the minutes for March 4th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Nay.
Motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. We are today going to be taking up the division report from the Game Fish and Forestry Division for Representative Dill. And Representative Dill, would you like to move the adoption of the Game Fish and Forestry Division report?
So moved.
Thank you. Representative Dill moves adoption of division reports for House Files 3328, 3547, 3032, 3280, and 3550. And again, we're doing this just to bring all these bills before the committee so we don't have to do them individually, so they'll all be here so we can move more quickly. All those in favor of the adoption signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Thank you.
They have been adopted. So, and Representative Dill, we will, are we going to do...
Have you got me up first or Anvil?
No. Okay. Representative Dill, do you want to move the...
Landfill?
Anvil, House File 3328.
I'd like to bring it before the committee. I'll move that bill, please.
Okay. Representative Dill, move House File 3328. First Committee on Growth Management be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Representative Anvil, would you like to come forward and present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. All of you are certainly familiar with the Forest Legacy concepts and the program. And the goal is, of course, to prevent the further private development of previously quasi-public forestry lands that are so common in the northern third of the state. This legislation allows us, gives us the mechanism to protect these forest lands, to continue to manage them in a responsible way for sustainable forestry, to continue to manage them for public recreational access, so that all of the state's stakeholders in public recreation have an equal opportunity to share in these lands, and of course the ecological and wildlife value that these lands possess. That's basically what the bill purports to do. We put into statute the concept of forest legacy, and the purpose is to conserve these forests in perpetuity for the ones that are going to follow us.
Very good. Any questions for Representative Anvil? Okay. Seeing no questions, Representative Dill.
I renew my motion.
Representative Dill renews the motion that House File 3328, First Committee on Growth Management, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Anvil.
Yes.
And Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to bring House File 3547 before the membership, please, and move that for
recommended to pass and go to Environment Finance?
Goes to Government Operations.
Oh, Government Operations. All right. Thank you very much.
And Representative Dilla moves House File 3547 be passed and re-referred to Committee on Government Operations. Representative Dill.
Okay. Thank you very much, members. I'll make a quick run through the bill and then answer questions. The first section, Section 1 has to do with aquatic farming. That came from Representative Scalzi. And it requires that the legislature report to us in odd numbers years the proposed license and fees that would make all aquaculture self-sustaining. As I remember, that they're spending, and Mr. Chair, Representative Lagunias and I haven't looked at their expenditures. We only have taken, you know, what they expended it on. but we will be looking at that, and they've stated somewhere around the mid 350 to 380 range on expenditures, with income about 180. The idea of this provision is to balance that out so that it's not a drag on the appropriate funds. It also requires that the commissioner shall encourage. Actually, it doesn't require. It says that they shall encourage fish farming in man-made ponds. And something, members, that I think is really important in this whole aquaculture scheme of things, that the department begin the development of best management practices for the long-term sustainability of aquaculture. We kind of came to that idea in thinking of how forestry has developed over the last 10 to 15 years. And how that at one time there weren't really standards, loggers weren't certified, the wood wasn't certified, and that we need to move towards some ways that are the parameters that the aquaculture people will work with them on and develop these best management practices. Then regarding the license, the next item down on line 2.29 is that it says that the commissioner shall not renew a license to raise minnows in a natural water body if it is subject to a protective easement that was purchased with federal waterfowl stamp proceeds. It will not issue a new or renew. So if you had one that is just renewed, you'd have approximately 5 years left. If you had one that was renewed 3 years ago, you'd have about 2 years left on that permit, and if you wanted a new one, you couldn't get it. Because you know, the expectation is very, very true. The expectation is when hunters or wildlife artists or whoever purchases stamps, purchases those, they have an expectation that those are used to restore or to maintain or even create waterfowl habitat so that waterfowl can enjoy their life and proliferate, hopefully. The next item is on page 3. Section 3, Representative Cornish. The problem is, not Representative Cornish, but his solution to this problem is that hunting licenses are relatively expensive, particularly non-resident hunting licenses. And, for example, a hunting license could easily be $100 non-resident. And they arrive at a local gas station or an ELS vendor, which we have about 2,200 roughly of them around the state, and they want to buy a license on a credit card. And so there's a transaction fee that the credit card vendor plus their percentage. So if you had a $100 license and you had a 50 cent transaction fee and a 3% service charge, you could pay, the vendor would lose up to $350 in that example of a $100 license. And so what this does is allow an electronic agent, an ELS agent, to charge a fee. And of a person using a credit, they may charge a fee, and they must post the signing information of what the fee is, and it must be clearly available to be read at the point of sale, visible, and as I said, include the fee. This has been something that's really been asked for across the state where licenses are sold. This is done as well in neighboring states. I hunted North Dakota and South Dakota, and that is done there. Their license is non-resident. For example, a pheasant license is around $110. Waterfowl license is $140 in North Dakota. That's a pretty good hit for a person to take by giving that service. The next item is on actually on page 4. It regards the horse path. And previously, the horse path had to be displayed on visibly on the person, such as having it on the outside of your clothing, or on the tack of the horse. Now, the horse path actually licenses the person, not the horse, to ride on a state horse trail. So what this provision on 4.4 begins to do is says that this is a valid horse path is not required. Well, actually, this particular provision says it's not required if a person is leading or riding a horse on a horse trail that is owned by them on the land that is they own. It's the same problem with snowmobiles. If a person gives a permit to go across their land with a snowmobile trail and they're out riding around and the game warden stops them, he could give them a ticket. He could have formally given them a ticket because he was on the trail even though it was on his own land. So it makes that the same. Also, this provision makes it so that the person must have the horse path on their person rather than on the tack of the horse or on their back. If you've seen in some instances where a state has a hunting license, like a deer hunting license has to be on their back or somewhere so a conservation officer can see it from a distance, this eliminates that. They have to have it on their person, like a hunting license in Minnesota. The next provision is on 4.9. It defines shelter, as a shelter means any structure set on the ice of state waters to provide shelter. That's a DNR provision. And then then there is a DNR provision that I believe that does the regarding the wild turkey management account. It removes the stamp provision. Sorry, I have to think about that one. I can't remember what that one is. I have it off the top of my head. DNR, more turkey things. A lot of turkey in this. No pork? Not yet, but we're coming to the pork. And then also, it allows $4 on page 7, it allows a turkey stamp account to receive $4.50 from each turkey license sold must be credited to the wild turkey account rather than 90% of the revenue from the turkey stamp. This is also DNR provision. And then refunds, this provision allows for someone who purchased two identical licenses to receive a refund on one license, one of the two, instead of paying twice. Section 15. This would say that right now, the person that is asking for a license, that no, right now, if you buy a license, you apply for a license, you have to state that you own it, you're a landowner, and then the DNR checks it out, and if you are a landowner, then they give you the permit. This change makes it so that when you apply for the license, you tell them where you're the landowner, they give you the permit, so you can go ahead with your life, and then they do the same search, so they're not doing anything more or less, they're just rearranging the search. Of when they're going, the search of the records. And then if you didn't, if you lied, which, you know, we wouldn't want to do, then there's plenty of penalties which Representative Brookavina will love. And he's always in favor of those. Okay, then we come in Section 17 to resident small game. This requires that a person under 16 does not have to have a hunting license at all for small game. This would require them to get a license. They'd have to go to the ELS and get a license, but it's free. The purpose of this is so that we can get some increased demographic information, know who's out there in what areas of the state that they're hunting, where they're from, if they're from the southern part of the state, they're hunting in the northern part of the state, if they're from the northern part and they live in the northern, and they're hunting in the northern part, vice versa. And that way, and when it comes to that information, it'll be very usable for this committee and for Representative Genius as well to try and predict the future. The DNR will use it, but really Representative Genius's committee will find it very helpful to have this information. In terms of big game, it does exactly the same thing for a resident. I have to think how we structured this again, and it makes in both instances, the small game and big game, a person 10 or 11 can now, under this, that's line 11.19, they will be able to hunt under the direct supervision of a parent or guardian without a fee, and you'll notice on line 1120 it says within immediate reach. So the reason we did are putting that in there is so that young people, slightly younger than before by 2 years, can have an opportunity to go out in the field and hunt. They won't have to pay a fee, but they will have to be with another person, with a parent or guardian who has a license. And this idea is to get people out into the field, get them working or into the hunting earlier and try and hold them in it, keep their interest. Non-residents can do exactly the same thing as a resident, except there's a fee. They will have to pay the resident fee if you are a non-resident. And also the 10 and 11, the same thing, the 10 and 11 would have to be with supervision of a parent or guardian. If you look down on line 1133, it says immediate reach, but it doesn't say without fee. So that means they would have to pay the fee. Then there's an adjustment in the line 12.3, page 12. There's an adjustment in the turkey fee. Some of these things are DNR, from $18 to $23. There's an all on line 12.17. There's an all-season deer license that is allows you to take 2 deer anywhere in the state, and it's open for just the fire. That's a firearms. An all firearm season. So if you bought this license, you would then be able to hunt anywhere in the state. You would be able to take 2 deer. You would be able to use muzzleloader and or rifle, either one, during the appropriate season. Non-resident hunting, we're making an adjustment that that's on line 12.33, a slight adjustment, the same amount as the resident, up $5 to $78. And that's a DNR provision. Hunting and waterfowl stamps has to do with the makes the hunt and migratory waterfowl stamps and the pheasant stamp the same amount. Fish houses and shelters, it includes for in terms of the licensing, this is a DNR provision. It includes, in terms of the license, the addition of shelters to the definition, or you pay a license for those. Remember earlier in the bill, it defined a shelter of anything that's placed on the ice for the purpose of shelter. So it includes shelter in all of these different licenses, such as the annual fish house, dark house, or shelter that is not rented, $11.50, and so on. Then also there is a add shelters to the line 13.27, add shelters to the fish houses for non-residents. So really what it's doing in all of those sections is adding shelters to the definition and to the charges that can be charged. In on page 14, subdivision 16, a resident bear hunting and outfitter's license is established, and this would allow a bear hunting outfitter to pay $82.50 for a outfitting license, and then to have additional persons under his license for bear hunting or for bear baiting and guiding, and we would be collecting the same fee, $82.50. So for two people, it would be $165, and any more that he adds under his license would just continue to accumulate at $82.50 each. This came from the bear hunting guide group. This is something that they wanted, so we included that in the bill. DNR, this is the next sections are DNR regarding validation of stamps. And the next items are in section 27 is more regarding firearm safety certificates to take big game. About reaching the age of 12, if you are 11 and you get the firearm safety certificate, this allows you to go forward and be able to hunt big game. Representative Powell's provision for crossbow expands the use of crossbows. Last year we established that you could take deer with a crossbow. This would allow for bear and turkey during their respective firearm seasons. No other seasons, not archery, just under the respective firearm seasons. Possession of firearm, the next section is the Representative Briner. It allows the possession of 17 caliber rimfire cartridges, 22 short or long rifles, ammunition, and 22 magnum caliber ammunition during the period of time when you can't possess a firearm or ammunition out in the public, 5 days before deer season and 2 days after deer season. So this allows for varmint hunting. Those are popular varmint calibers, so you could still continue to take the appropriate varmints that you might be hunting where you can't do that now. These are very popular varmints. The next section 30, the crossbow permit issued under this section also allows the permit to use a crossbow with a mechanical draw device that releases the crossbow. That's more of a technical item that the DNR needed, because some people use the draw device. And then DNR, a person may not take big game by archery while in possession of a firearm. So you can't have, big game, I meant deer. Deer, they scratch big game, or strike big game, and make a deer. So you can't be out hunting with you can't be hunting during the archery season, have a firearm in your possession. And then, actually I had one time I shot a deer with a bow and arrow, and I was laying on the ground. The arrow went clear through the deer, which a lot of times it does. And the conservation officer happened upon me, and he examined that thing to no end to see if it was a bullet hole or an arrow hole. I can't believe he would think I'd be doing something illegal. But apparently, for a few moments, he thought he'd better check it. An all firearm season. This is more information on the all firearm season that we talked about earlier. And then there's a clarification on the bait hunting with aid of bait or feed prohibited. There was some confusion over how that was put in the bill last year. So this is the clarification language from the DNR. And then in section 35, which is on page 18. In the case, this is regarding a bear hunters, and in the case of a drawing, the commissioner shall allow a person to apply for a permit in more than one area and then rank their choices. If a person is not selected for the bear hunting permit, the permittee may elect to have the license fee refunded or held and applied to a future license. One of the problems is people go in and apply for a license, they're granted, and then they don't pay for the license. So we're making it so that if they're really serious about the hunting, they got to pay and not try and use up the licenses and then not pay. Actually, it could be, I could tell you that up in Manitoba where I goose hunt, there's quite a group of people that oppose goose hunting. And so in this quota zone, they sign up and go out and they sign up as a hunter and use up the land on a daily basis. So no one, when you sign up and use the land, no one else can use it. And then they don't show up to hunt. So in essence, they're protecting the geese, similar kind of a thing. More information on section 36 about bear hunting guide outfitters, the same thing we discussed earlier. And then Representative Hackbarth has a provision in Section 37 regarding raccoon hunting. It allows it a half hour after sunset and one half hour before, which is a slight change by, I believe, it's a half hour on each end of the day. Representative Bingham has a item that is a fairly specific area that the DNR had no problem with, the Turkey Federation supported, regarding shall allow 4-week open season for turkeys in the fall in the area designated as Area 601 for the 2008 season. She has an abundance of turkeys with feathers in her district, and so she is wanting to hopefully thin them down a slight amount. And then another DR provision with about stamp validation. Then there's a Representative Eakin provision in the bill. That's in Section 40. And that extend the end of the season for up to 2 weeks in experimental lagers when the harvest of the species is less than the harvest goal. So, as I recall, Representative Eakin's bill was intended so that if they don't meet the quota or the goal of harvest, that they could extend the season and allow anglers additional opportunity. And conservation license, section 42. This would establish a conservation license, which would the license would, for fishing, would allow half of the normal limit. And the half of the normal limit cost for the license would be two-thirds of the normal license. So you would be getting one-half of the limit for two-thirds of the cost. And this was an idea that we came up with to start some voluntary, hopefully some voluntary conservation. Now we don't have a note on this, to my knowledge, yet of what the cost may be, and this may be a fairly lively discussion in Representative Wagenius's committee. So we'd like to discuss it if you like, and then get it to her committee. And then there's also a change on about fish houses left overnight. And it adds in the structure language. The structure is all through this in many places because of the idea that they're redefining that. And then there's a provision in here about the confiscation of the structures, and that is on line 22.32. The subdivision also applies to structures left on state public access sites for more than 48 hours past the deadlines. What's happening is that, let's say you're at a state public boat launching ramp, and someone pulls their shelter off of the ice, and they get it up on the state boat launching ramp, and then they leave it. Well, I mean, they've left it on public property where other people have equal access and use of, and so this allows for a penalty. Representative Westrum had a provision in here that opens the season. The spearing season through the ice ends the last day of February. So what this really does is it makes it so that as soon as the ice is thick enough in the judgment of the individual, they can go on there. There's no beginning date. There's just an ending date. And so if you wanted to go out there and the ice was 3 inches thick, and you can do that, and you can still spear. The DNR didn't have any opposition to that. And it also takes them off the hook for trying to decide what waters are safe and is it not safe and things of that nature. There is a provision on Section 50 about the lake trout on lakes that are partially within the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. Right now, if a lake that is outside of the that is partially outside or fully outside of the Boundary Waters closes on March 15th. The lakes inside the Boundary Waters close on March 31st. So if you had a lake that was half in and half out, which there are several of, that lake closes as if it were totally within the Boundary Waters. This extends the season 15 extra days there, as well as the lakes that are just on the outside of the Boundary Waters. And remember, those lakes are a very narrow band of lakes across the Canadian border where the trout are, in that very cold, clear water that exists up in just some of the lakes, not all of them up in the Boundary Waters, but in just some of the lakes. Then there's a provision in Section 51 about walleye, that you may have no more than one walleye larger than 20 inches and one northern pike larger than 30 inches daily. If you'll notice, the word daily is stricken and now in possession. So that's the change there. And then there's Representative Cornish's bill regarding the reports on uncased firearms. That will be coming to us next year and list the many of the questions. There's Representative McNamara's provision about the third rooster pheasant after the 16th day, I believe it is, of the season, and there was no biological reason that the DNR testified that wasn't possible. And then there's the bear hunting drawing procedure where the commissioner will use the good cause exemption to adopt the rules to do those things that we talked about, bear hunting and drawing, and how that the license fee is collected when they make their application for the bear hunting. And then there's the repealers. The first repealer on line 24.27 is the waterfowl stamp and signature requirements. That is the subdivision 2, 97A, 411 subdivision 2. These are all DNR things that they ask for. And then parts 6232.0200 are the definition of bait, and those subsequent things are vague regulations and are amended in both bill and the statute, these repealers. So there's a lot of provisions in there as well. I think we'll, maybe Mr. Chairman, we could discuss the bill, and then I've got an amendment I want to discuss as well. But why don't we go through the bill, whatever questions the members have.
Okay.
And then we'll also have, if the DNR is here, or those who have expertise in these particular things, on specific questions, we might call them up.
Okay. All right. Any discussion then or questions for Representative Dill or the DNR? Representative Osman?
Yes, thank you, Chair. I was looking at, on page 11, we were talking about the free license for doctors. Are they able to get those free licenses electronically? And if they are, who pays the cost for doing that?
Well, that's a good question. And the DNR did not tell me that there was a fiscal impact to do that, to give out the free license in this proposal.
Is there any Representative Osman?
We can talk with them if someone is here from DNR that can ask that question. Here comes Mr. Boggett. I mean, we consulted with them on the language. That did not come up in discussion. That's a good question.
Welcome, Mr. Boggess.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Ed Boggess, DNR Division of Fish and Wildlife, and Representative Osment. We haven't done a fiscal note yet on this bill, but there would be some programming of the electronic licensing system required to issue these licenses. I don't know the cost of that. I think it would be relatively minor. There's also a transaction fee of any transaction on the electronic licensing system that currently is, I think, 86 cents per transaction.
Representative Osment.
Thank you, Chair. And I'd really like to know a little bit. I think this is well intended, but if we're going to have proprietors across the state now going to be responsible for issuing out free certificates, then somebody's got to pay for their time. and I don't know exactly, and as well as electronically, when we do it over the computer, we use a company, or at least we did, they were even located out of state, and they required a fee in order to make the transaction. I assume that has to be paid, unless somebody's going to start being really generous on all this stuff, these free certificates. I'd like to get an answer to how that would work eventually, not necessarily today.
And, Mr. Chairman,
President Dell.
Well, obviously, there are quite a few things in here that are going to have some impact one way or the other, and so it's my intention to address those in that committee, in that appropriate committee. And Representative Lugenius and I have already talked about at least a couple of items in here.
And a fiscal note has been requested on this. Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dill, I just had a question about the horse pass on page 3.
Mm-hmm.
And I just was wondering, just, you know, with the background, I know after the last time we had some changes, I heard from a number of horse enthusiasts, and they were unhappy with changes we had made in the bill. I just wondered if you worked with those groups very much on this, and is that kind of where the language came from?
We had some complaints, and that's how we, otherwise there wouldn't have been anything in the bill. That's
okay.
How we kind of came to this conclusion and how to address it. Was because of the complaints. I think that one of them was from your district, as I recall.
I think it probably was.
Yeah.
And so that's how we got some letters during the summer, a letter or some mm-hmm. letters during the summer, and so we put it on our list of things to do.
Yeah. I just wondered if they had been satisfied with that.
Yeah, I think Representative Anzell might have had one too, as well.
Thank you.
But it just seemed to me to be something that made sense. About having the license on your person, especially if, you know, if you were riding a variety of, you know, group of horse riders are riding down a trail and they have it on the tack that's issued to a person, and then they stop and then they all change horses. Well, now they'd technically be illegal. You know, you couldn't change horses unless you change the stuff off of their tack or on the back. You know, unless they put it on their back or on their person, I should say, where it's visible. So that was the reason for the change.
And that would be for dry land as well as midstream?
I've never forded a horse across the river as a sailor.
Representative Lugenius.
Thank
too. Back to page 11. I get it about young folks not paying the fee and what you're trying to encourage here, but what I don't get is not requiring to have a safety firearm safety certificate. My discomfort is this: you're telling somebody that they're not competent to get a certificate, but they are competent to hunt. It gives me a mixed message here. So that's one of my questions. So help me out there.
Okay, are you referring to on page 11? Let's just take as an example line 19.
Mm-hmm, I am.
Okay. The logic in that is that we already have the safety certificate that they need to get at age 12, but that there are some people that are not going to have they're just being introduced into hunting, and that they are going to have to be out there with I believe you have to be age 12 or 11, almost 12, to get a safety certificate. And now we will be able to have people out there, 10 and 11, that are under the direct supervision of another hunter or a parent or guardian, so that they can introduce them into it. And I just felt like there wasn't a need that if they were going to have a parent or guardian out there supervising them under direct and immediate reach, that they would need to go through getting a safety certificate at that time in their life.
Representative Virginia.
I am uncomfortable with that notion. I mean, that we are telling them they're old enough to do one thing, but not old enough to do another. So there's another way of looking at that. I mean, that's the way I am looking at it. And it's the same thing in the non-resident one.
Right, the non-resident.
But let me ask you about...
Virginia, let me give you one more piece of information that I can on that. One of the things that I know that you can do is ride a snowmobile without you can ride a snowmobile without someone else on a snowmobile with you. The parent or guardian under age 12 just has to be in the immediate vicinity. You can drive a boat from the day that you're born until you get a safety certificate for 29 horse and under. And there are a litany of things that youth can do that they need no certification that could be considered by some at least, dangerous if they operated improperly. And so my original thought was to emulate those laws. And then after talking about it in committee quite extensively, we came to a bit of a consensus. I wouldn't say Representative Simpson was particularly interested in this, as you are. So that's how we came up with the 10 and the 11.
I'm just thinking about an unintended consequence here. My family owns some land, and it's great hunting land, just because got good woods and water and stuff like that. And we allow two different families to hunt on it, have for eons. I am more nervous about allowing those families to hunt on the land, knowing that there could be kids that don't have safety certificates, and thinking about my own personal liability, because I know now that those kids are there without their safety certificate. So I'm thinking, am I more reluctant to let folks come on the land than I was? I mean, we don't charge them or anything. They're just families that have just done this for years. Am I now more reluctant because of this? And I think I am. So that's just, there's another way of looking at that.
No response.
No response.
I think her reluctance is her business.
Okay.
We need to promote youth being out in the deer stand, and we need to, we need to promote this, and we need to get these kids started earlier. I think that you will find that over time, if the more the kids are involved in hunting, particularly when they're under the direct supervision of a parent or guardian, you're going to find people that are more responsible later during that following time period. And the fact that they're under direct supervision within arm's reach, I think, tempers the risk that Representative Genius has brought forward. Okay, and I think it's a provision that should be well founded and well thought of.
Representative McNamara to this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Wagenius, those are really good questions. And I would just use my own personal experience. Under current law, 10 and 11-year-olds are not able to hunt big game, but you can hunt small game as long as you can demonstrate an ability to shoot the gun. You can hunt when you're 8, 9 years old and wing shoot with a shotgun, and you're not required to be in the same confines that this law would require for deer hunting. My own experience, when both of my sons first hunted, we hunted out of the same tree, and it's a very, we both actually, I have to think, we did have two firearms, I think, always in the tree. You could be in a situation where you may even only have one firearm between the two individuals. It's a very great introduction for people. This is to be, I envision it with the new stands, that there would be two people in the stand. One would be the 10 or 11-year-old, and then the adult. And it's a very good experience, and it'll introduce youngsters to the big game experience. And they may not even actually pull a trigger. I don't think that's the important thing. The logic of the firearm certificate, the firearm certificate instructors discourage 10-year-olds from taking the class because of the competency level of the class, that it's really intended for 12-year-olds. They will allow 11-year-olds, and I think in rare instance, I'm not even sure one of the DNR can answer, but they really don't want 10-year-olds to take it. The test is sophisticated enough to where it works better for 11 and 12-year-olds. Minnesota is a state that has encouraged youth to be active in their outdoor sports, including hunting. If I'm not mistaken, again, the DNR could speak to it. Representative Hansen just mentioned that we opened up the turkey to allow young to hunt turkey. But if I'm not mistaken, the DNR maybe could comment on this. You have to demonstrate the ability to shoot the gun. If you're stopped by a CO, a youngster, Representative Hansen mentioned that very young were acquiring licenses. They're breaking the law if they don't have the ability to show that they can discharge a firearm, including that it goes to bow and arrows, too, to where people have misused and bought a bow and arrow license for somebody, archery, I guess, bow and arrow, the old time. But I think this is really important, Representative Deal, and I appreciate that you narrowed it down to 10 and 11-year-olds, because I think we run the misuse. But there's a lot of youngsters that first introduced and had the ability to wing shoot. My business partner's son was a terrific shot at 8 and 9 years old. Very good wing shot. He certainly would have been able to sit in a deer stand with a rifle, a 6mm or something, and shoot a deer, but was not given that opportunity. And I think the more we can encourage and put people together with their parents in the outdoor environment or the supervisor, I think is a good idea.
Thank you. And Representative Moe, thank you, guys. Representative Hack. Well, he's. Representative Hackbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the same issue, Representative Bill, and I should probably have Mr. Spoggett come back up, but on the same issue, am I to assume then that if we have these kids out there with their parents or guardian, are we assuming that they have bought a deer hunting license already, or is it state that anywhere, or do they have to be? The point I'm trying to make is Representative Osmond asked about the cost of this. And maybe we can work this somehow with whoever the parent or guardian is out there hunting already with a deer hunting license. You know, maybe, you know, that right there says that, you know, maybe we can put something on their list that says they have somebody that they're hunting with. And maybe that's a way to cover it. I'm not sure, but I think you have to assume that whoever's out in the woods with them already has a deer hunting license, even though it doesn't say it here in your language. I think if you're out there hunting, you know, if that person's out there hunting, those person has to have a license too. Because I think if people are out there driving deer, except that they need to have licenses, even if they don't have a gun.
Well, Chairman, my assumption was that this person that is out there with that 10 or 11-year-old would be a licensed hunter, although I don't believe it says that
But that's why I wanted Mr. Boggess to come down. Because I think if you're calling the woods during deer hunting season and you're helping and taking a deer, you have to have a license. I think that's true.
Okay. Mr. Boggess?
Or maybe, I don't know if Mr. Boggess can answer that or Horstman's can.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hackbarth, I think Pat Watts is here from our Division of Enforcement, but I believe it'd be correct that if they're assisting with taking, then they would need to be licensed. We've got some different language for turkey hunting that allows some assisting, but we don't have that similar language for deer hunting. I see Ms. Watts, I think, can probably answer it more definitively.
Okay. Don't go far, Mr. Boggess, because I've got some more questions for you.
Welcome, Ms. Watts, if you can state your name.
Good evening. My name is Pat Watts, and I'm with the Department of Natural Resources Enforcement Division. And if I understood the question correct,
would the person that's accompanying the 10 or 11-year-old need to have a deer license to assist in the taking of deer?
Yes, the committee, they would need a license to assist. The statutory definition of take in 97A015 includes acts of assistance. There's some exceptions for small game during, like, the take a kid hunting weekend and that type of thing.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Watts.
I'm sure willing to, if we need to put something in this to make it more clear, or if they do it through the book, you know, through the pamphlet, I'm fine with that. But if we need, it was my intention that the person that is with the 10 or 12-year-old would be in immediate supervision within essentially arm's reach and be licensed to take the deer.
Right. And Mr. Chairman and Representative Bill, I don't think we need to put anything in there to clarify it. My point was that the person is going to be out there with an adult that has already purchased the license and probably would be able to cover the cost of it because they purchased that license. That's all I have on this issue, Mr. Chairman, but I do have some other questions about the turkey language that's in the bill.
Okay. And I'm not sure, Representative Hackbarth, did you have a question to this issue? Okay, Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And there's a number of different spots in the bill pertaining to the turkey license purchase and the stamp purchase, etc. And as you might know, I think Mr. Boggess knows that I was the one that put this place, brought that forward for the turkey stand. My concern is, do we know how much money is in the account? And is the stamp account helping now? Does it need more money? I'm just wondering, do we need to change, maybe we could add a buck onto the license? Or if we need to, I'm just curious at this point, what kind of shape is the account in?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hackbarth, I don't know the balance in the account right now, but we're selling roughly 40,000 spring and fall turkey licenses a year times the $5, so it's generating, it's actually 90% of that. So it's somewhere between $150,000 and $200,000 a year that's coming into that account, and the turkey stamp was the last stamp that was established. And it was established at $5, and all the other stamps since then have gone up to either $7.50 for the hunting stamps or $10 for the trout salmon stamp. But just, it may not be real clear because, as Representative Dill pointed out, there's numerous references to turkey license fees and stamp fees. And what's happening in this bill is that we're eliminating the actual stamp for validation as a licensing document, rolling the fee into the license fee, because we're still having a number of people, even though a turkey license is only valid for turkey hunting, under current law, they need the license and the stamp. A number of people are buying the license and not realizing they need to buy the stamp. We're just saying, let's just combine the two into one fee, put the money into the account.
That's the
$450, so they no longer need the stamp. We'll still produce it and sell it to collectors and things like that, have the contest, but they won't inadvertently end up without a stamp when they need one. Regarding the health of the account, I guess it's just how much can we do with it. It's used for turkey management and research and acquisition and those sorts of things, and we don't have any proposals this time to increase that fee. This is designed to be revenue neutral. It actually may raise slightly more revenue just because now if you buy one stamp for spring, it's also good for the fall. This would just say you paid the additional $50 or $5 for the spring and the fall license. So there would probably be some slight net gain here, but it's designed to not really raise more money, just make it more streamlined.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and that's exactly what I want to know. I just wanted to go over that, and Mr. Bogus, if you could check and see where the balance of that is. And I know that somebody probably came forward and said we need to raise it if it needed to be raised, but maybe by the time you get to Representative Levine, you can know what it is. Now, maybe we should raise it $1 or $2 or something. Like you said, it's last stamp and it's $5 and all the other ones have gone up. Maybe they need a little boost there. I don't know. So I could talk to Mr. Glines about that also to see where we're at. But it'd be helpful to know. As long as we're changing it, maybe we can change it now if we're going to have to change it. And that's the only point I wanted to make. And thank you for breaking that down. I wanted to know and get it on the record that we're still going to have the contest, and you're still going to have the stamp, and it's still available if you want to buy it, if actually have the stamp sent to you.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Dill. I think just following up on that line of questioning by Representative Hackbarth, I'd like to move the 08-1278 amendment.
Representative Hansen moves the 808-1278 amendment. Representative Hansen to the amendment.
And I have discussed this with the chair and with the DNR, and I think when you look throughout the game and fish bill, there's all kinds of references to the turkey statute. And I know, Representative Hackbarth, you were involved in a lot of the success of the turkey program with the stamp and that. And after 30 years of the turkey program, we're seeing changes, you know, a legislative request to change something here and tweak something there. And I think that this amendment would get in recommendations about not only the question of dollars, but also, the, you know, we have these landowner tenant issues have gone back and forth over the last few years. We have a provision in here looking at providing an extra time for a certain permit area. And the intent of my amendment is to have the DNR come back to us with some recommendations next year so we can look at this a little broadly, more broadly, rather than a little bit here and a little bit there based on individual members.
That sounds like something that is needed. So any discussion or questions? Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think it's a good idea, too, that we probably should do it. I don't know if we need to put it in the actual amendment or not, but I would like to see that the DNR would work in consultation with the National Wild Turkey Federation on these recommendations. And I know if we need to make an amendment, we can put that in. Maybe if council could give us a recommendation.
Want to put it in?
An amendment to the amendment. Just that the Commissioner of Natural Resources would, in consultation with the National Wild Turkey Federation, to provide the legislature with the recommendation. That's not
it. Chair and members, the amendment would read on line 1.5 of the 808, the 1278 amendment. After resources, insert comma, in consultation with the National Wild Turkey Federation, comma.
Incorporate that in the amendment?
Yes, I would incorporate that in the amendment.
Okay. Chair. Representative Dale, any comments?
Yeah, I'd like to have the committee support the amendment. I have to tell you that this year, last year, at the end of the year, and this year, I think I've had more turkey discussion than I care to have. And I think it's something that we need to take a look at. Maybe just, as Representative Hackbarth said, these things have been kind of brought along as the sport. You know, we didn't used to have turkeys like we have now. and now we've got them sitting in trees by the dozens and metro areas and places where we never dreamed of having them. And you see different things about zones and how we split up the stamp, and whether if you're out there with, like Mr. Boggess said, it's time to take a more comprehensive look at that. Not that I learned that we probably will ever be able to streamline anything around here, but maybe we can at least take a shot at it, literally.
Any further discussion? Okay, seeing none, everybody understands the amendment that was incorporated by Representative Hackforth. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. And I do understand there's another amendment as well. Sorry, Representative Osmond.
I just have another question on another part of the bill.
Okay, go ahead.
Bill, as you're looking on page 23, line 19, you have a section there about the change in the language from not having taking of walleye, a large walleye or northern pike, to in possession. And first, I'm kind of wondering as to what it is you're trying to accomplish there. And then second, the reason I'm raising that issue is because when I look for the definition of possession, it becomes quite cloudy as to when this would ever, when you would ever not be in possession of the large fish. If we're catching them to put them in a freezer to eat versus catching them to put them in a freezer for future mounting, or you know what, because you're talking about the larger fish here, so, and I looked for a definition that would try to give me some clarification, and I really couldn't find that. So I don't know if that, it may exist in some other part of the statute, but I can't find it in the Game and Fish statute.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to inspire her to get them up and talk about this, or is that the enforcement person?
Probably enforcement would.
Ms. Watts is on her way down. Hmm.
Ms. Watts.
Hi, members of the committee. Possession is defined in the definitions in 97A015. And includes both actual and constructive possession. And the history of possession through the courts dates back to colonial times, so there's a lot of history there, and it's well established. If someone were to take their one walleye over 20 inches, for example, into a taxidermist, since it is still their fish, they would still constructively possess the fish until it was mounted or turned into the mount. And that can sometimes take some time. They used to bring a fish into a taxidermist. My dad always used to tell me, if he's going to tell you he's going to get it done in 30 days, you don't want to leave the fish there. It can take up to a year. It's not unusual. Typically, when you get your mount back, depending on the technique they use, there's not any fish parts left in with the fish. I mean, it's not a fish. It's been a mold that's been taken from the fish and that's been mounted. But until the point in time when that fish has been processed and is well down the road in the process of being turned into the mount, it would still be considered to be in your possession.
Representative Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. How about if I want to turn that fish into fillets and I'm going to have it around for a while in my freezer? If I eliminate it from ever catching a larger fish and keeping it, and shall I have eaten all of the past fish?
Mr. Chair, Representative Osmond, you would need to have consumed that fish, yes, or otherwise given it away to someone before you could take another fish of that size.
I'm not trying to be difficult.
I'm
trying to say that we're changing it from a daily restriction to a restriction that's really unending and very difficult to enforce. I don't know how you'd even, it'd be extremely difficult to prove
Yep, Mr. Chairman, most of us, you are correct. To go into someone's home freezer, you would either, the officer would either need permission, you know, from the individual to search the freezer, or they would need to obtain a search warrant. So you are correct. It is difficult to prove and to demonstrate and basically to enforce your correct.
And to me, it would be, Mr. Chairman, members, it's one thing if you have the different fillets from individual fishes, but now if you have a large fish, and you have the large fish cut up into different pieces, I don't know how you prove it was a large fish originally, or when that fish is already now finally out of your possession. It really presents a difficulty in both directions, for both enforcement as well as for the individual, the way it's currently worded. That's the reason I started off by asking, what is the goal? What is he really trying to accomplish?
Representative Dale.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you well know that I have a very, very efficient conservation officer that lives up in northern Minnesota. And that I'd like to amend this, make an amendment, an oral amendment, to strike the language that is changed in Section 51.
Okay.
Because I can see the same problem as now that it's been explained to me in more detail. This is a DNR provision that they brought to me, and now that I hear it, I can already see my very efficient conservation officer being brought up here again at this committee. So my amendment would be to strike to get rid of all the change language in the bill.
Okay.
And Section 51.
Representative Dill moves an oral amendment to strike the changed language in Section 51. Back to the old language.
Delete
the whole section. Okay. Delete Section 51. Any discussion, Stephen? Okay. And we can have advisors remember all the rest of the bill. Okay. Everybody, understand the amendment? Any discussion to it? Seeing none? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
The DNR, Mr. Chairman, might be getting a little too efficient, too.
So, Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question either for the author of the bill or for Representative McNamara. Just looking at the back page of the bill, Section 53, page 24, when we're looking at the pheasant bag limit after the 16th day, was there, and I missed this part of committee that night, was there any discussion about the, I'm following up on what Representative Osmond said, and Representative Powell and I were already talking about this. Was there any talk about possession limit, or do you need to eat more pheasants if you're out hunting?
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dell.
There wasn't any discussion on the possession limit.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Dale, for the if you're a good shot and you're hunting in a good pheasant area, your possession limit is now going to be 2 days' worth instead of three. And I'm not opposed to that. I'm just wondering if we want to think about that at all.
Representative Dale?
No, we don't want to think about it.
Okay.
Maybe after the 24th day or something? Complicate things even more?
This, Mr. Chairman, this is the same language that passed and made it all the way to the conference committee last year. And so we're going to go forward with that, this language.
Okay.
But thank you, Representative Hoppe, for your thoughts.
I like the thing.
And we do have a couple other amendments. Representative Hackforth, did you have an amendment you want to offer?
Oh, how about the A-Foreman?
Okay. Representative Hackforth moves the A4 amendment. Representative Hackforth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This amendment, Representative Dill, when he was explaining this bill, did refer to the Western section of the bill that talks about the open season for steering. And I haven't had a chance to talk to you, Representative Dill. This is laying on my chair right after I got back from session, so I haven't had a chance to talk to you. But I did check with the DNR, and they seem to be okay with this, and they can come up if you want to. But this is, again, a further change, and they seem to be okay with it, and Representative Weston talked to me about it on the floor, and he said this was a change that he wanted to make. So I would encourage everyone's support. It does put an opening date
on the steering, which wasn't in current law, and it moved out the end date of the second Sunday in March.
And Representative Dale.
And I recall from the discussions that Mr. Boggs was here, I don't think they have a problem with this. It was a relatively open-ended proposition when we discussed it in the Game Fish and Forestry Committee, and I'm fine with an opening date. Mm. Still up to the individual person and their own responsibility to determine if the ice is safe to get out there. If it is, and there are rare occasions, at least there are occasions up north that the ice is thick enough to go out. So I'm in accordance with this. This is the amendment is fine.
Okay. Any other discussion of the amendment? Seeing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. And there is another amendment, Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The A3 amendment. I move the A3 amendment.
Okay, Representative Hackbarth moves the A3 amendment. Representative Hackbarth.
Mr. Chairman and members, this is an automatic voter registration amendment. And I was at a conference down in Branson, Missouri, the end of November, and it's the Congressional Sportsman Caucus. And this is an issue that is kind of sweeping the nation. There's a number of states that are addressing this. And the Congressional Sportsman Caucus is behind trying to get people to register to vote. Young people, when they go to buy a license, for example, are not registered to vote. And this will automatically sign them up for voter registration. And also in the bill, you can, if you don't want to be registered to vote, you can deny registering to vote if you like. But this will automatically, when you go to buy your license, sign you up for voters, or register you to your vote. That's what it's all about.
Okay. Representative Hackbarth, and I think that it's good to be encouraging people to vote. So, Representative Dill, do you have any comments on this amendment?
I haven't had time. This is the first I've seen the amendment. I didn't go to the event.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Dill, I'm sorry I haven't had a chance to talk to you about this either. We were talking about introducing this as a bill, and I do have a bill drafted for this too, Mr. Chairman. And there are going to be some costs to it if you look on the back of the back page. And we're going to be requesting fiscal notes. And Mr. Chairman and Representative Dill, maybe we can talk about this and maybe it represents Virginia's committee, or maybe you'd like to put it on the bill. If they go into GovOps, you can talk about it there. But we are going to request a fiscal note, and we can take it out of the bill if it's going to be too expensive. I'd like to move forward with it at this time, though, Mr. Chairman. And as long as it's going to GovOps, we can talk about it in that committee. I think it's going there next anyway, right?
Yep.
And that'd be the proper place to discuss this. And maybe by then we'll have the fiscal note, too.
Okay, and Representative Wagenius.
Well, I'd just like to remind members that on Tuesday we are going to be holding a hearing where the governor folks present their proposals to cut the budget. So we are not in a position, we're in a position not only to have no money, but we will be doing substantially cuts, I assume. We don't know what they're going to be, so that's something members may want to consider.
Okay. And any further comments? Representative Dill, any thoughts?
Well, again, Mr. Chair, I haven't had time to look at it. I guess my inclination would be to put it on in Representative Wagenius's committee once we have some additional information, and I've had time to look at it. I think that it sounds like a real good thing to do. But I just don't have enough information, don't understand it well enough yet.
I wanted to bring the amendment up so we could be aware of it and talk about it a little bit. It's only going to be a little bit of a difficult situation right now. So when I get the fiscal note, maybe we can do it in representative of the committee. I'll withdraw the amendment for now, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you.
I wanted to bring the discussion forward, and I am going to be offering it as a bill.
Okay, thank you, Representative Hackbarth, for bringing it forward. And Representative Hackbarth withdraws his motion to amend. Representative Wagenius.
Well, Thank you, Mr. Chair. The one problem I see with that strategy, just to help you out a little bit, Representative Packbar, is that we're nearing policy deadline, and this would have to go to other policy committees, that we are not an end for this kind of thing. We would be the beginning.
Okay, any further discussion? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Dill on line 10.2. We had that in, I think, the last year's bill, and I know Representative Osmond or Representative Wagenius, I think we ran into trouble with the Senate on that word, changing from person to resident. I think we had this in the finance bill. So I just wanted to alert Representative Dill that 10.2, and alert Representative Dill that we had this in there before and we lost in conference committee, and that they might run into some, I can't remember what the reason was, but there was some Senate opposition to it.
Mr. Chair, why don't we have Mr. Bach give the history on this particular item? Be here, so. Okay.
Mr. Baga.
Mr. Chair and committee, which
10.2.
Line 10.2.
The residents regarding a deer license, they have a list of deer. 10.2, page 10.
You could give us a reason why that was changed.
Yes, Mr. Chair and committee, I think it was the Representative Hansen initiative last year to strike the provision for the pre-landowner deer license that requires that the person live on the land. And after session, as we started issuing those licenses, the question came up with the intent to apply this to non-residents and to residents. It had never applied to non-residents before because they had to live on the land, and obviously if they live on the land, they're a resident. So our assumption is that the intent was to apply this to residents only, but we wanted some clarification of that. So that's what we're seeking.
Representative Hansen.
Representative Deal, that was the intent, and we actually had it written that way, but it was changed, I believe, in conference.
Okay. Any further comments or questions? Representative Osmond.
Well, it seems to me that the change is appropriate, but the way it's currently worded, anyone can come in and possess, once you're in possession of 80 acres, you get a free license. Mm-hmm. Whether you're a resident of the state or not. So it seems to me that this change is very appropriate.
Okay. Thank you. Any other comments or questions on the Representative McNamara?
A different point.
Sure.
Thank you. I don't mean to beat, in this case, a dead deer or dead horse, but if I can go back to 11/19, 11/20, I started to think about this again, the 10, 11-year-olds, and what some of Representative Wagenius's thoughts started coming back to me. And Representative Dill, you did mention that the intent was, if I understand right, for the 10 or 11-year-old to be able to shoot the deer of the parent or guardian. They wouldn't actually be acquiring a second free license. Is that a true statement or not?
Representative Dill.
When Representative Wagenius was out of the room when Ms. Watts came up and talked about that, so the person that is supervising the youth, the 10 or 12, must have a deer hunting license because they're assisting in the taking of the license, and it would be their permit that the youth, the 10 or 11 year old, would be hunting on.
Okay. Yeah. So, Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you. And Mr. Chair, I guess, Representative Dill, I don't want to do it here, but I guess when we get to Representative Wagenius's committee, I would want to entertain the idea that the 10 or 11-year-old be allowed to hunt with the parent, but they only possess one legal firearm between them. I think we need to entertain that idea because I've begun to think through this where I envisioned two people in the tree stand. I really wasn't worried. But then I started thinking about them being a field and the opportunity of a deer jumping up and the thoughts and this young gal or boy that had never taken gun training. I'm thinking that maybe if we could talk between now and when it shows up in Representative Lagunias's committee, I think we need to think out the implications of that. And I guess I'd like to work with both of you on that issue.
Okay, Representative Dill, any comments?
No comment on it particularly.
Okay, Representative Hackbrink?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a little problem with that, Representative McNamara, because depending on arms, you know, there's youth rifles and there's youth shotguns, and have just, you know, are you going to have an adult out there with just one, maybe just youth shotgun or youth rifle? I'm a little bit concerned about doing that, too, setting one firearm in there.
Well, you run the risk of, then the youth would be using an adult firearm that may not fit.
Right, yeah.
In that case.
So you'd want a firearm for the youth that's going to be appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And then the adult would have his. And so that might be a problem if you have only one firearm. I've been taking my son out in the deer stand with me since he was 5 years old, without a gun, of course. But other hunting trips and things, I mean, he's had youth-appropriate firearms all these years. And so I have a huge concern about that.
Representative McNamara.
Well, I respect where you're coming from, Representative Hackbart, and I agree. I'm envisioning that, you know, they may have to, if they're hunting in the shotgun slug area, they may decide to use the 20 gauge, and it's a gun that they both. My guess is if they're in this situation for the most practical purpose, you're going to allow the youth to take the deer. That's what this is about. So the gun would be a gun that the youth can have. My thoughts are then when they're afield, walking to or from the stand, the youth may not be in possession of the gun. It would allow the opportunity for them not to, because as they're, I see some problems here. Potentially, I like the idea of encouraging them, and I like the idea of them being able to actually take the deer. Potentially, I'm just concerned about the movement and enforcement. I see Colonel Ham's not here today. I'm hopeful that maybe he would be here when we're in front of Representative Lagunias's committee, because as I like this idea and I like the idea of the youth, I'd also like to visit hear from enforcement about demonstrating the ability to take the game. Because I think there's some instances where people are misusing that, and I want to maybe they need to clarify in law here. I think Representative Lagunias brought up some good points that I hadn't thought about. I'm concerned about the movement afield, and I understand where you're coming from, Representative Hackbart. I mean, you'd have to, if you're going to have the youth 6mm up north, the parent, it's just a shorter stock, and however you decide to do it, and we've all been there, I mean, or many of us have.
You said it yourself earlier. I mean, you're off, you know, wing shooting at an early age. My kid went out with me squirrel hunting at his own 22. Part of the fun of going out with your kids and walking through the woods is that they get a kick out of carrying the gun themselves, and you teach them those kinds of responsibilities. So, I think I disagree on this issue, and I sure hope that we don't have to get down to just one gun in this case.
I think there's maybe a concern, too, if you take it down to one gun, that might be discouraging people from doing this activity with their children. They may be less likely to do it if they can't be hunting along with their son or daughter. So, any further comments or questions? Okay, seeing none, Representative Dill, would you like to...
I'd like to renew my motion, please, recommend the pass and to government operations.
Okay, Representative Dill renews his motion that House File 3547, First Committee Engrossment, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Government Operations.
As amended.
Thank you, Representative Osmond. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. So it's passed. David, yeah, Representative Dill, you're up again. Are you guys? Okay. That's right.
I'm used to it.
Are we doing 3280?
3032.
Well, is that the land? I don't have a tag.
Yep, yep. 3032.
Okay, well, I can do that one without it. So I'd like to move the bill, please.
Representative Dill moves House File 3032, First Committee Engrossment. He recommends to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
Okay. The lands bill, at this point, should be non-controversial. It has all the provisions that are contained within the lands bill.
Chairman? I'm sorry, you said, firstly, you said 3280, and then you just moved 3032.
The 3280
is the lands bill.
Oh, yep, we got the wrong one here.
3280, Mr. Chairman, is the expedited land exchange bill.
Right. Yep. So we moved the right one.
Okay. Should be moving House File 3032. Okay. The land bill is, like most of the land bills that get here at this point, generally it's non-controversial in the sense that the DNR has approved every single transaction that is referenced in the bill. If we have questions about any of the particular transactions, Ms. Lewis is here to answer the questions.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Dill. Any comments or questions for Representative Dill? Seeing none, Representative Dill, would you like to renew your motion?
I'll renew the motion for House File 3032, please.
And Representative Dill renews this motion that House File 3032, First Committee Engrossment, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevailed.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I just want to mention, I think there are going to be, as the bill continues to move, the DNR is working with some other members to have some bills that we'll probably amend onto that bill eventually. And those are going to meet the same litmus test in terms of approval by the department. So, Mr. Chairman, then I'd like to move House File 3280.
Okay, Representative Dill moves House File 3280. First Committee Engrossment be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Representative Dill.
I'd like Ms. Lewis to come up and explain the bill. It's pretty technical. So rather than me trying to talk about all these different classifications and things of that nature, I think she'll probably do a better job of it tonight. Okay.
Welcome. If you could state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kathy Lewis with Lands and Minerals, DNR. This bill comes from the DNR. First section of the bill provides for an expedited process for the exchange of publicly owned lands. There's primarily going to be lands that are going to be exchanged between the Department of Natural Resources and the counties. They are focusing on consolidation of ownership. There will be cost savings from the title work and from the valuation process. And one of the things here is to help reduce forest fragmentation by consolidating ownership between the government entities. They can reduce management costs and identify which lands need to be maintained and used for forest purposes. A few highlights in the different parts of Section 1. Subdivision 2 identifies the classes of land involved. And we have not included the school and university trust fund lands at this point in time. That's in the Class 1 lands. We're including the other DNR lands, tax prohibited lands, and lands owned by other units of government. What we want to do is give this program a chance, make sure it has enough safeguards in effect to meet our fiduciary obligations. If we find everything works really smoothly, we'll come back in another session to include trust lands. Subdivision 3 provides that we can also use, in addition to appraisals, we can also use real estate broker analysis for determining the value of the land. We must include the timber value in the consideration. Subdivision 4 allows the use of title insurance. Subdivision 5 recognizes that as provided in the Constitution, you need the unanimous approval of the Land Exchange Board. So you have a check and balance here, and that's the Land Exchange Board is the Governor, Attorney General, and State Auditor. Subdivision 6 is a technical provision. It looks at who exchanges deeds first. Subdivision 7 provides a provision in there on reverter. It makes sure that the parties involved are exchanging the land for the purposes of managing the land not for the purpose of getting the land and subsequently selling them. And if there was a case that arose, such as identified trespass or something or another public purpose, they'd have to go back to the exchanging party and get permission to actually sell the land. And subdivision 8 is just a technical provision recognizing the land exchange takes on the class of land that it was exchanged for. Section 2 of the bill concerns the requirement that the county board approve DNR's purchases of wildlife management area lands and scientific and natural areas. Currently, if the county board fails to act or fails to give a reason for disapproval, the DNR or landowner may appeal to the land exchange board. If the county board approves and provides reasons, then the appeal goes to the district court. What this does, it says it removes the district court from the process and puts the whole appeal process with the land exchange board. And this is consistent with the process currently used by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service when it's buying lands in Minnesota under the Migratory Bird Conservation Act. Any more questions? Be happy to answer, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Lewis. Representative Lagunias.
I'm having trouble with Section 2 on the appeals process. And maybe it's because I'm not reading it right, but you require all land exchanges under the Section 3 require unanimous approval of the board, which is fine. But then they become the appellate group. And my sense is with two things. I think that that's troubling to me, but it also tells me that when you remove the district court, this bill has to go to the Judiciary Committee. I mean, I think that's very clear, because that is their jurisdiction, removing the district court. That's them. So I don't understand why you're using the Land Exchange Board as the appeal when they are the approvers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Genius, the Land Exchange Board, the sections do not relate to each other in a bill except that they involve the Land Exchange Board, but Section 2 of the bill's concern is that the DNR, when it purchases land for wildlife purposes, the county board has to give its approval before we can identify that for wildlife management purposes. And the Land Exchange Board has no role in that part of the function. And what it happens here is, this is addressing a situation where the county board says no to the DNR, you cannot purchase those lands for wildlife management purposes. The Land Exchange Board has not been active in the process up to that stage.
I understand what you're doing, nonetheless. I do think this has to go to the Judiciary Committee because you're removing the district courts from the appeals process, and that they need to be satisfied that that is the correct thing for this. I personally still have some questions about that. I don't have to have a question answered if the Judiciary Committee is going to answer them.
So, Representative Lagini, if you wanted to go to a different committee, you think, from here?
I believe that it's because we are removing the district court from the appeals process,
but
the
Judiciary
needs to go to the Judiciary Committee. Yes.
Okay. And Representative Dill,
comment on that as well. If we're removing that Representative Lagunias is an attorney. It works for me.
Okay. Representative Lagunias, would you want to make the motion then to have this?
Thank you.
Referred?
I would. It has nothing to do with being an attorney. It really has to do with the process here.
It has a lot to do with being an attorney.
It has a lot to do with the process here, and the process here says that court functions go to our Judiciary Committee. So I would like to amend the motion to have the bill go to the Judiciary Committee with recommendation. I think it's a good idea to work on these things like this. But that's
okay. Representative Wagenius moves that the motion be amended to be referred to the Judiciary Committee. Any discussion? Be the Public Safety Committee deals with those issues. So all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and the motion is amended.
Now you have to pass.
Any further discussion of the bill? Okay, seeing none, Representative Dill.
Okay, I renew the motion as amended to send House File 3280, recommend the pass to the Judiciary Committee.
Okay, Representative Dill renews his motion that House File 3280, First Committee Engrossment, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. That would be correct, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. Okay, and we have one more bill, we do have a session coming up soon here, too. So, Representative Hansen, if you'd like to move your bill.
I'd like to move House File 3550 and refer it to the Finance Committee.
Okay. Representative Hansen moves House File 3550, First Committee Engrossment, be recommended pass, and be referred to the Committee on Government Operations.
To refer to Finance.
Oh, Finance. Oh, that's right. Got it written off the side here, too. To be referred to the Committee on Finance. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we went through this last evening. I do have an oral amendment that on page 9 to strike section 14, which is lines 9.7 through 9.11.
Okay, Representative Hansen moves to strike on page 9 to strike section 14, lines 9.7 to 9.11, to get it into the shape that he would like. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. And Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is House File 3550 as amended, is the Department of Natural Resources' response to viral hemorrhagic septicemia. It deals with transportation restrictions relating to stocking of fish, restriction on essentially adding species on the official list of DHS susceptible species published by APHIS to the restrictions that are current with salmonids and catfish. It also puts some limits on exchange of fish or wildlife resources and some limits on transportation. We have just stricken the rules section. The DNR believes that they have the authority under existing rules to be doing some of these items. And I would ask Mr. Boggs come forward if folks do have any questions.
And any questions at all for Representative Hansen or Mr. Boggs? Okay, seeing none, Representative Hansen, I'd like to renew your motion. Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 3550, First Committee Engrossment, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is passed. And that is it for today. Meeting adjourned.